Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I'm innocent of any crimes of murder, and expose the truth of COINTELPRO and illegal practices of the Hoover Nixon regime.
That's right.
So I want to thank you again.
I want you to have this. What are you going to be doing next?
It's hard to describe. You know, for 27 years, and they give me the worst thing that you could ever conceive. And I still have brothers like Rochelle McGee, Hugo Pernell, that's still
right.
In the hole.
That's right.
And they have no reason in the hole. Beautiful brothers. Romaine Fitzgerald, the only Panther we lost to death row for a murder he didn't commit, and everybody in the community knows it. And that's one thing I want to say. When someone like Johnny Cochran comes and tell you that I'm representing this man from the community, that means the community has empowered him. Johnny knows what's going on. Johnny is deeply rooted in the community. So all of this that Garcetti is saying, I contribute to the power of the people, so that the continuous struggle, that we will never relent when we're faced with injustice. I can contribute personally to Stu Hanlon.
Geronimo Gijaga on the steps of the Orange County Courthouse, June 10th. 1997, after he had served almost 27 years in prison, 8 of them in the hole. Our guests also attorneys Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran. Stuart Hanlon, who has come to be involved with the Sarah Jane Olson case, a Bay Area attorney. Johnny Cochran, of course, known for representing O.J. Simpson, also now Puffy Combs. During the O.J. Simpson case, Johnny Cochran, you said that the real story, the real case that people have to know about, because he was still in prison at the time, was Geronimo Pratt. Why?
Because it obsessed me. Because no matter what happened in my career, no matter what we did, he was still locked up, being held by his government wrongfully. And so it was something that we lived with every day. And I took every opportunity to speak about it. And I remember being interviewed, because we were really focused on the Simpson defense, but I remember being interviewed over the lunch hour by a lady from GQ. And she asked me about what was really important. And I said, well, you know, it's important what you're doing in your job. But that case was what I was thinking was important to all of us. And at that time I said that the prosecutor, who is then now a judge, a Superior Court judge for L.A. County, wasn't fit to be on the bench because he had allowed, we had known, Stuart had uncovered in 1977 that this man, Julius Butler, was an informant, but the courts chose to turn a blind eye to that. They became part of the conspiracy too in the cover-up. So I took it upon myself to say he wasn't fit to be on the bench. Turned out that was kind of prophetic, because later on, when we got a hearing finally in 1996, they used that, among other things, to transfer us out of Los Angeles County, and that's how we got Judge Dickey. The plan, however, was to send us to this conservative kind of Orange County area, but we got a judge who understood what it meant to be a judge, an honorable man, Everett Dickey, who had the courage to listen to the evidence and give us a hearing. And he was the one who was instrumental in getting Geronimo released. There were a couple other things we got. As you know, a DA's investigator, after 25 years, went right down in less than a minute, went into a safe, a locked safe, and found under B for Butler a card which said he was a confidential informant, their informant. Now, you can't tell us they couldn't have done that 25 years before, but that happened, and we got that. And then
Of course, also you got the testimony of a former FBI agent, Michael Swearingen.
And he one thing he showed us is the proof that Geronimo, the FBI, knew he was in Oakland at the time of the murder, because it was the first time he ever found logs and records of wiretaps that were missing. And the fact that they were missing the wiretaps of the Oakland office and L.A. office during this two-week period at the time of the murder, I think the officers were proof that they knew he was there.
So really, it was the FBI wiretaps that helped to save you, Geronimo Gijaga, because you were a leader working in the Black Panther Party, right? And they were tracking everywhere you went. And if you were up in Oakland, they were tracking your phone calls. And Swearingen, seeing that they were gone,
Right.
And also later.
But, see, but I think that has to sink into the listeners. The FBI, by its own wiretaps and surveillance, knew that you couldn't possibly have committed that crime, and yet they went along with and participated actively in the framework.
I think people have to understand the greatest threat to our society is letting law enforcement run wild with the approval of their higher-ups, whether it's J. Edgar Hoover or Bill Clinton or Janet Reno, whoever it is. When we give law enforcement unlimited power, unbridled power, democracy falls apart. And that's one of the major lessons of Geronimo's case, because people have to understand what law enforcement does when they have unlimited power. They will always do the same thing. They will do, the ends will always justify the means, because their ends are to get their view to take over. And it's just incredibly destructive. And,
that's right.
You know, it's just a... And two other policemen came forward who were wonderful. They were old men at this point, two LAPD officers, two African-American officers came forward, and finally, with a lot of encouragement from Johnny, who knew them, finally told the truth that Butler had been an informant for them. And I just think they didn't want to end their careers with this lie on their record. So they were amazing.
But why, even with knowing that Butler was an informant, did that mean that what he said was a lie?
Well, I think that what happened was, meant the whole thing was a lie. What the judge had said, that if, and it was interesting because by this time, one of the jurors, Jeannie Hamilton, who had reluctantly changed her vote and voted for guilty, had said if they had known, imagine if at the trial, when you can cross-examine a witness and bring out the fact that you are an informant, you're working for the FBI, they put this case together, and have him say, no, I'm not that, no, I'm just being a good citizen, I'm just doing my civic duty. So it cut at the very heart of everything. So that's what made it so. It affected his credibility. He lied about everything. I mean, we could then demonstrate that. And furthermore, we found out that his big testimony was he had this letter he'd supposedly written to protect himself. Well, the letter was written by the FBI. The FBI had the letter all the time. They set it up. They got it after he wrote it. So it was all part and parcel. And what we found out, as Stuart has mentioned, is that we found out that he'd been caught with a machine gun. He was working. He was worried about himself, and he was working off this case. The LAPD phonied up a report to cover for him, to get him out of that. And so he was working it off, and Pratt was the victim of that. And that's what happens in these courts. And you know, you got to, as Stuart says, the big thing and one of the messages we want to get out is that in all of our society, there's this issue of who polices the police. And the police are basically, the police officer on the beat and the others are the single most powerful figures in the justice system. More important, more powerful than the Supreme Court. Look at the New York Times today, where you see this racial profiling, why they stop and they search and they can shoot, and very little's done about it. So Geronimo Pratt is another result of that. So if we don't wake up and pay attention to this and learn a lesson, what's happening in Los Angeles now in this Rampart scandal, which is of epic proportions, and people just kind of like are going along with it, you know, kind of sitting there and like, well, you know, those guys were gang members. Well, gang members, they were framed, shot, maimed, and now they got to pay all this money, and people are kind of sitting down saying, well, you know, this is what happens. It's preposterous.
One of the I think, most emotional parts of the book, Geronimo, was when you end up in the same prison with Huey Newton years later, who, of course, was an icon to many of us in the 1960s, but who then clearly fell apart in the later years of his life. But and he's the guy who expelled you from the party, who called you every name in the book, and suddenly now you're in prison, and he is brought back. I think it was on a parole violation.
Yeah, it was a sad day to see him come.
And of course, everyone expected now you were a leader of the prison that you would, in one way or other, try to get retribution on Huey. And could you tell us a little bit about what happened?
It was sad to see Huey after all those years come in, after going through crack. He was it's a sad reflection of the man I had known. Huey was, I think, along with Eldridge, right at the middle of the essence of the center of the bullseye from COINTELPRO. Huey was always a great man, as with so many others who we are so quick to criticize without understanding the objective analysis. When you are targeted by COINTELPRO in such a way where there's someone is spending, say, $50,000 a week, you know, just to employ people to victimize you and to target you, even the strongest, it's hard to stand up under that. And I thought
Huey, Eldridge, and so many others stood up pretty good under that. But it was sad. And Huey, when he come in, we didn't harm him. We talked to him, gave him vitamins, and exercised him. And he began to rejuvenate himself. And he became very remorseful. So he contacted Stu, and they had a press conference, and he refused to leave prison. He said because he felt personally responsible for telling the Panthers not to testify for me when they knew that I was up there. And so far as expulsion, at that time there was no more Black Panther Party, so everybody was expelling everybody. So he was expelled by someone, this person. So we don't look at it like that. We don't look at it as a Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver faction. In our view, maybe if we had more time, we could talk about that. But, it was sad to see Huey. And he, of course, was assassinated a year after he left. And strangely enough, he was trying to redeem himself in the community. And but it's not strange to us that they would, get him out of the way now because he's getting healthy again. And he's had, Stu might want to talk about how he had talked to Stu about doing more to clear up all of the wrongs that he had done, you know.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, May 27, 2021. So I have been told, very fitting, we are reading this book and wrapping it up for so-called Memorial Day. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, two-tour veteran of Vietnam. I'm sure those will be some of the films that they'll have playing over the next few days or so when they want to show all their patriotic films and U.S. soldiers going off, democracy and all the rest of Geronimo Pratt right there for Memorial Day. We got to hear, that was, again, Gus T's BFF, Amy Goodman, with Democracy Now! Some years back, going way back in 2000. This is after Mr. Pratt had already been released. And they were talking after Jack Olson's book that we are currently reading, Last Man Standing, had been published. You got to hear from Johnny Cochran, Geronimo Pratt, Stuart Hanlon was also in that interview. I thought it was so important. Amy Goodman, she mentioned Johnny Cochran, O.J. Simpson fame, and Mr. Pratt's attorney. And she said, now representing Sean Combs. I said, ooh-wee, I already said, what is the next book we are reading? Labyrinth, The Assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. It is the exact same people, same city that we have been reading about for, 7 months now? L.A., Big City of Dreams, LAPD. Johnny Cochran's name is all through that book. O.J. Simpson's name is all through that book. The LAPD, Rodney King, all the same people that we've been reading about. Just put all that together. Labyrinth, next book. Whenever we get done with this one, we'll do our trifecta for Los Angeles. But before we get to that, we will wrap up. We have one or two more sessions left to go in this book, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. This is our 13th session on the text. Hopefully something constructive, learning about the Black Panther Party, learning about the system of racism, white supremacy, and how white people lie. Last thing I'll say, I so appreciate Mr. Pratt, his commentary on Huey P. Newton, Dr. Huey P. Newton, and how especially he said we're so quick to criticize these victims of white supremacy and COINTELPRO for what they did or how they responded or what they didn't do, and saying, man, when you got an apparatus, when they can have $50,000 a week, that's probably on the low end, just to conduct surveillance and study and analyze you. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. Remember Lynn Atkinson when she was saying that no-count scum Huey P. Newton? Oh, that son, I don't want to talk to him. Oh, I don't want to meet. White women. Getting started. Context of white supremacy. This is audio segment one, Last Man Standing. Chapter 62, Julio Under Oath. Cochran had stayed up till 4 a.m. preparing questions for the witness whose testimony had doomed his client to the company of killers, roaches, rats, and his own body wastes. The lawyer intended to expose former Deputy Sheriff Julius Butler as a liar and informer who invented an impossible scenario that dishonest law enforcement authorities were happy to embrace since it matched their own agenda. The previous October, at the trial of another well-known African-American, Cochran had asked prospective jurors, "You know, don't you, that it's possible for a peace officer to walk through these doors, take that witness stand, raise his right hand, and swear to tell the truth, and then absolutely lie? Do you believe this happens?" Now he had to drive home the same point about a leading churchman and pillar of the black community. Julius Carl Butler was 64, his diameter and dignity expanded by 10 years as a member of the Los Angeles County Bar. After he was sworn, it soon became clear how far he'd distanced himself from Julio, the cell leader, and Mother, the hairstylist and cosmetician. He used lawyerly terms and emphasized his polished persona by wearing a tailored gray suit, a neatly knotted tie, black shoes, and dark-rimmed glasses. His wavy hair was still full and glistening, and his spade-shaped goatee was shot with gray. Under Cochran's careful questioning, the community leader described his 4 years of service as a deputy sheriff, mostly involved in handling prisoners, and explained that he retired in 1960 because of domestic problems. "I wanted to leave town." He was discussing his earliest contacts with the Black Panthers when Brentford Ferreria registered an objection that threatened to halt the proceedings on the spot. "This is history," he told the judge. "This is all in the trial transcripts. I thought we were going to limit ourselves to the issues the court wanted to hear about." Dickey overruled the objection. At the petitioner's table, Hanlon glanced at his client. He was nodding. It was always a good sign when Geronimo Pratt Esquire agreed with a ruling. After more questions about Butler's role in the Panthers and his friendship with LAPD Sergeant Dwayne Rice, Cochran asked the witness if he knew a police captain named Ed Henry. Ferreria objected again. At this point, he complained to the judge, "We are retrying the case." "Your Honor, we are not," Cochran responded. "The trial took 8 weeks." Again, the objection was overruled. Butler had been on the witness stand for an hour when Cochran began leading up to Richard Kalustian's post-trial assistance to his star witness. Seated at their table, Cochran's colleagues studied Judge Dickey's expression. They'd been warned by insiders that he was fiercely protective of his judicial colleagues and would brook no disrespect toward any of them. Cochran brought up Butler's convictions in the Ollie Taylor beating case and asked, "What assistance did Richard Kalustian, who you knew then to be a deputy district attorney, what assistance did he give you, if you recall?" Butler said, I believe when I wrote to I went through my probation officer. I wrote to the court regarding entering law school. That is my best guesstimate of the time frame. And then I asked what was my actual charges because I didn't know the actual charges. Question. Now, you had been a sheriff's deputy? Answer. Yes. Question. You knew that you had been charged with felonies at that point, did you not? Answer. Yes. I didn't know that I was sentenced to a felony. I assumed. I wasn't sure. Question. You found out at some point you had been sentenced on the felonies? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Okay. Now, my question is, what, if anything, did Kaloustian, a deputy district attorney, do for you regarding the reduction, if any, of these felonies? Answer. I believe the aggravated assault charges were dropped. I am not sure. Question. And that he helped to have that happen? Answer. I believe so. Question. So let me see if I understand what you are telling us, that you asked Mr. Kaloustian, who you had come to know, to help you get your felonies reduced so you might be able to go off to law school. Did you write Kaloustian or call him? Answer. I don't recall. Question. Well, let's see. Did you ask him to help you at some point, sir? Answer. I just answered you. Cochran looked at the judge. Dickey had interrupted his busy note-taking and was looking at the witness. Cochran wondered what he thought of Butler's terse answer, so he repeated the question. Ferreria began an objection, but before he'd stated his reason, the judge snapped, "Objection is overruled. You can answer the question." Answer. My best recollection is that he got back to me sometime and said that I actually had pled to a felony and that steps were made to reduce it to a misdemeanor. Something to that effect. Question. Did you see Kaloustian during this period of time? See each other face to face during these periods of time? Ferreria. Objection. Vague as to time. Question. I am talking about at the time when you were talking to Kaloustian and he agreed to help you get the felony reduced to a misdemeanor. Did the two of you ever see each other face to face in 1974 during your first year of law school? Answer. I believe yes, sir. Question. How many times did you see each other during this time frame? Answer. I don't know. Maybe two or three. I don't know. I can't recall. Observing his co-counsel at close range, Hanlon was impressed. Johnny was tough and persistent, but he was always gracious. He never said, "Thank you." It was always, "Thank you very kindly." He made people like him, but he wasn't obsequious. You could see his effect on the judge, the clerk, the bailiffs. After Cochran had established the existence of a convivial post-trial relationship between Butler and Kaloustian, he turned to the heart of the matter, whether Butler had been an informant a source, a mediator, or a liaison. He asked, had you ever used the word informant to describe yourself? Never. Ever used the word snitch to describe yourself? No, sir. Cochran read from a report by the DA's investigator, Steve DePrima, in which Butler was quoted as admitting that he'd been rewarded for his work as an informant. It is incorrectly stated, the churchman replied. It is not exactly what I said. Question: weren't you given some money to buy a gun? Answer: that's correct. Question: you bought a gun, didn't you? Answer: you said, or the gun. Question: I don't want to argue. Answer: I don't either, but I want the truth to be told. Question: let's see if we can get it, the truth. In a soft voice, Cochran asked if Butler was familiar with the laws of perjury. Objection, Ferreria called out. Argumentative. Cochran dropped the question. He knew it was argumentative, maybe a touch improper, but its intent had been to remind this certified liar that perjury had consequences. Cochran asked if he'd ever informed for the FBI. Butler replied, I don't remember any admissions of informant. No. Question: have you seen documents which indicate that not only did you inform on, but you had numerous contacts with the FBI, including informing about a Thompson machine gun? Ferreria, objection as to relevance. Dickey, overruled. Question: so now, and do you recall in that same hearing me asking you if you had ever worked for the FBI? Answer: yes, I think I do. Cochran read from investigator DePrima's report and stopped at the line in which Butler was quoted as saying, I do not want to get my friend in trouble. I am going to ask you now, Cochran said, who was that friend, Mr. Butler? Who provided you with the money to purchase this gun? It was Maury Bowles. Question: District Attorney's Investigator? Answer: yes, sir. Question: what date was it? Answer: I believe it was somewhere in the... I think it was somewhere, maybe... I'm trying to think. Maybe in the latter part of 1970. Somewhere in there. Question: this would be the time when you are on probation for a felony, and you are given money to buy a gun by a person in law enforcement in Los Angeles County? Is that what you are testifying to? Answer: that is possible. Question: if that date was correct, you were on probation for the Ollie Taylor felony at that point. Isn't that correct? Answer: if that date was correct. Question: as such, you would be an ex-con with a gun. Isn't that right? Answer: I am pretty sure I wasn't an ex-con at that time. Cochran flipped open the bound transcript of the Pratt murder trial and said, before we conclude for the day, I want to ask you if you remember testifying back in 1972. Question: did you ever inform on anybody? Answer: no. Question: you never did that? Answer: no. Do you remember giving those answers? Butler said, probably. Question: do you remember talking to two FBI agents on or about September 12, 1969? Answer: I spoke to FBI agents on several occasions. I could not give you the dates. Question: do you remember on December 10, 1969, that you telephonically furnished the following information to the FBI? You told the FBI that Elmer Pratt owned a Thompson machine gun, silver steel in color. You go on to state that the Black Panther Party in Oakland allegedly had a rocket launcher and Eldridge Cleaver had a 50 caliber machine gun, which is mounted on a truck. Do you remember telling them that? Answer: I remember the conversation about a rocket and machine gun on a truck. Yes. Question: when you testified under oath after swearing to tell the truth that you haven't informed on anybody, you were lying, weren't you? Answer: no, sir. After the judge's formal recessional at 4:03 p.m., Cochran, Hanlon, Drouse, and Chapman conferred with their client in a holding cell adjoining the courtroom. Geronimo sat on one side of the bars and the lawyers huddled together on the other. It was a sore point with Pratt that his lawyers were forced to confer with him in a sardine can. But today he seemed more concerned about his attire. Ebony magazine had shown its support by providing him with a blue double-breasted suit with matching accoutrements, and Geronimo despised every thread and buttonhole. "This ain't my style," he complained. "I don't wear ties. I want one of those suits like I used to wear. You know?" Drouse said, "You mean like the suit you were arrested in? In Dallas?" "That's it." "Where the jacket looks like an open shirt? And the lapels have piping?" "Right. A leisure suit with that cool polyester stuff." "Jesus Christ, Geronimo, it's not 1970, Drouse reminded him. "They don't even make those suits anymore. I'd have to look in thrift shops." Pratt seemed surprised at the news. After a discussion about style trends, he agreed to a compromise. He would wear a modified Panther outfit, dark slacks, and a black outer shirt with a powder blue shirt underneath. Anything would be better than an itchy wool suit or yellow jail clothes that made him resemble a large canary. Hanlon asked his expert opinion of the judge. "Well, he's no Kathleen Cleaver," Geronimo replied. "He's no Cowell, no Cronenberg. He acts like a real judge." Drouse said, "Sometimes a true conservative can make a better judge than a half-ass liberal." The stubborn Hanlon withheld judgment. "We've been screwed so many times," he said. "He's probably just bending over backwards so he won't be reversed." Timothy Pratt and his sister Virginia were in a good mood as they drove back to her house in Los Angeles. They'd never thought they would live to see Julius Butler struggling to answer Johnny Cochran's pointed questions. Later, Tim described his feeling in writing. In essence, Butler was the prince of evil. The thought of losing in this second battle with Cochrane was laughable. Butler had become so comfortable with himself that he was convinced he would beat Cochrane. He'd beaten him before with lies. He would do it again. But on this day, Butler got tangled in his own web of deceit and lies, and the more he attempted to extricate himself, the more tangled he got. On the witness stand on Wednesday, the third day of the hearing, Butler again disputed FBI and LAPD documents about his role as a police informer. Brentford Ferreira objected to almost every item of evidence, and the judge overruled almost every objection. Geronimo stared intently at the witness who'd conspired with police to put him away for life. "I just felt sorry for him," he said later. "What a poor fool he was. Worse than an Uncle Tom. Nothing I could do to Julio would be as hard as what he had to go through every time he looked in a mirror. Mother Butler. Such a sad, useless man." Only once through the intensive questioning did Butler admit that the hated appellation, informant, might apply to him. A fired-up Cochrane cited comments by Sergeant Dwayne Rice and other LAPD officers to the effect that Butler provided them with information about the Black Panthers and even led them to contraband weapons. Question: so Sergeant Rice will know about that incident also because he was present, right? Answer: yes. Question: and so will Captain Henry? Answer: possibly. Yes, I'm sure. Question: and those two men believed that you were an informant and you helped them in recovering these weapons with information throughout the year? Answer: I don't dispute their belief. Question: could you dispute the connotation that you were, in fact, an informant? Answer: no, I was acting as an informant. But later, Butler scuttled back to his earlier position that he'd been a mediator or liaison between lawmen and the Panthers. He described FBI memos about his informer status as incorrect, false, inaccurate, wrong, not true, and argued that the information he provided to police could not be described as confidential because he'd also shared it with his landlady and neighbors. As the day wore on, the church leader began to revert to his old street fighter pugnacity. He frequently said, "I've already answered that," as though he were in charge of the examination. Whenever Cochrane appeared on the verge of pinning him to specifics, his memory turned hazy, or he mumbled that the question was poorly phrased. When he described Long John Washington as someone who wouldn't have the balls, Cochrane interrupted to say, "We're in court. You might want to watch your language." Butler turned toward the bench and said, "Excuse me. I'm sorry, Judge. Forgive me." Dickey said, "Go ahead and answer the question." A few minutes later, he declared a recess. During the break, an annoyed Cochrane told a reporter, "Everybody, the FBI, Los Angeles police, DA's investigators, believes Julio was an informant except himself. He can't bring himself to say informant. Cochran accused Butler of engaging in semantic sophistry and added, "This man was an informant. We should have been advised of that. The jury should have known that." Back in the courtroom, Cochran brought up the FBI's many visits to Butler and his spirit of cooperation with the agency. Question: Mr. Butler, you know how to say no, don't you? Answer: yes. Question: if somebody wants to talk to you, if you don't want to talk to them, you say no? Answer: yes. Question: so when the FBI agents came on all these occasions and wanted to talk to you, and you could have said no, isn't that right? Answer: that's correct. Question: you didn't say no? Answer: yes. Question: you talked to them? Answer: yes. Question: you informed on your colleagues, didn't you? Answer: no. When Cochran introduced the delicate question of how a pair of COINTELPRO agents happened to be a few feet away when the super secret insurance letter was handed to Sergeant Rice, Butler darted from one position to another. First, he claimed that no FBI agents had been present and the very idea was ridiculous. Then he admitted that it was possible that two white law enforcement officers had pulled up in a car and tried to talk to him. Before he finished testifying, he claimed that the incident hadn't happened, might have happened, might not have happened, and that he didn't recall. At last, Cochran dropped the subject. "If I can tell he's lying," he said to himself, "so can this judge." Timothy Pratt watched the proceedings from a seat next to an African American who appeared deep in thought. After Pratt learned that the man was a retired law enforcement officer, he blurted out, "Sir, do you have any idea of the pain and suffering our family has endured as a result of the frame-up of our brother?" The ex-lawman appeared disturbed by the question. "Please," he said, touching Tim's arm, "just wait till you hear my testimony." Timothy moved away. The man sat alone, he wrote later, looking like someone with a heavy weight on his shoulders. The next morning, Thursday, December 19, the anonymous seatmate took the witness stand and wasted no time in confirming that Julius Butler had been an active informer for the Los Angeles DA's office. He identified himself as retired Lieutenant Frederick Willis and said that he'd been a DA's investigator for 26 years, serving as Butler's handler in 1969 and 1970. He confirmed that Butler had also informed for the FBI during that period. Willis's notebooks showing date, time, and place of his meetings with Butler were introduced into evidence. During the lunch break, Hanlon and Cochran polished their plans for Richard Kaloustian. They'd already decided that Hanlon would conduct the examination, with Cochran standing by to provide support. "Not that you wouldn't do a great job," Hanlon told him, "but you're too angry. You might piss off the judge." "I have no respect for Kaloustian," Cochran replied, "and I've said so in print. Maybe I can examine him and not show my feelings. Maybe I can't. Let's not take the chance." Chapter 63, Mr. Kalustian. Just before Superior Court Judge Richard Kalustian was scheduled to take the stand, the Pratt team received a harsh reminder of Judge Dickey's protectiveness about his judicial colleagues. Co-counsel Robert Garcia stood up and said, "The next witness is Mr. Kalustian. We request that Mr. Kalustian be referred to solely as Mr. Kalustian, not as Judge Kalustian, not as Your Honor." The request made Hanlon a little uncomfortable. Garcia was a veteran of the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York City, a Stanford professor, and deep thinker, but he was taking the risk of offending Dickey over an unimportant bit of nomenclature. In this courtroom, Garcia plowed on, "There is only one judge. We believe that we are here in Orange County and not in Los Angeles precisely because of the concern that having Mr. Kalustian testify as a witness creates the appearance of impropriety and a potential conflict of interest." Dickey's aquiline nose crinkled up. "Who is calling him as a witness?" he asked. Garcia said, "We are." In a baffled tone, the judge asked, "You think I am going to give him some extra credibility because he uses his title?" Garcia started to respond, but Dickey continued, "That is ridiculous, Mr. Garcia." The NAACP lawyer pressed on. "That is, we are concerned with the appearance of impropriety in terms of Mr. Pratt, in terms of the public and the media." "Your request is denied," the judge announced in the loudest voice he'd used since the hearing began. "He is a judge. He is entitled to be referred to by his title. You don't have to call him Your Honor if you don't want to." The dogged Garcia remained on his feet. "We have been referring to Mr. Kalustian," he insisted. "We ask that that continue." "Denied. Call your witness." The courtroom was silent as Kalustian was sworn in. He appeared relaxed and calm, a handsome man of about 60, his luxuriant black wavy hair thinning and graying, and his heavy mustache peppered with white. Hanlon was a little surprised at his longtime enemy's appearance. In early newspaper pictures, Kalustian had put him in mind of a card shark, but now he resembled the affable uncle at a family reunion. Judge Dickey's face gave away nothing about his own feelings. "Who is handling?" he asked. "I am," Hanlon said. He turned to Kalustian and asked his first question, which turned out to be a croaky, "Good afternoon." His plan was to demonize Kalustian as Kalustian had demonized Pratt, but it was difficult because the man on the witness stand looked so benign. The word that came to Hanlon's mind was nebbish, New York Yiddish for ineffectual, harmless, ordinary. After the former prosecutor responded with his own pleasant good afternoon, Judge Dickey watched with the air of a mother hen as Hanlon launched into a staccato series of biographical questions that produced precise answers in a reasonable tone. But when Hanlon turned to the relationship between Kalustian and his trial assistant, Morris Bowles, the witness began to sound slightly more tentative. He said that at the beginning of the Pratt murder trial, he hadn't known that Boyles was a member of the Intelligence Division of the DA's Bureau of Investigation. He'd gradually learned Bowles' status during the trial. Hanlon broached the subject of the confidential informant cards. Question. And are you now aware, asking you, now, as of today, that the DA's Bureau of Investigation has confidential index cards on confidential informants? Answer, I am now aware. Question, when did you become aware of this fact? Answer, when Mr. Ferreria asked me whether I knew about a bureau card. Question. When did you leave the DA's office to become a judge? Answer. November 1985. Question. And up until 1985, did you have any knowledge that the district attorney kept confidential informant cards? Answer. No. Hanlon soon realized that he was gaining no ground and switched to the subject of the Black Panthers. Kalustian admitted that the DA's office regarded the BPP as a threat to the public. When Hanlon attempted to pursue the subject, Ferreria objected again, and the judge abruptly asked Hanlon, "What are you getting at?" Hanlon made another jump shift, this time to the Ollie Taylor case. Mr. Butler allegedly pled to four serious felonies without any agreement in your office, he asked. Just pled to the sheet and ended up with probation? Ferreria said, objection, counsel is testifying. Well, the judge told Hanlon, the problem with that question is, I don't know where it is focused. Let me rephrase it, Hanlon said, beginning to feel his collar tightening. Mr. Butler, based on the records we have, pled the four felonies involving false imprisonment and beating of Ollie Taylor, and pled to all four without any agreement, supposedly with your office. And my question is, in the Panther case, like this, at that time, did that seem unusual to you based on your experience? Vague, Ferreria complained, calls for speculation, assumes facts not in evidence. Hanlon started to respond, but the judge interrupted him again. It hasn't been shown that he had personal knowledge of those events. Sustain the objection. When the chagrined Hanlon tried to go on, Dickey said impatiently, he's already said he is not even sure he remembers. He just assumed he remembers it. So how can you get into any detail about whether he was surprised or found it unusual? Hanlon said, I think he worked. Let me try it one more time. If the court feels it is inappropriate, I will move on. He shuffled some papers and asked himself, how'd I get off on such a wrong foot? Was it the cockamamie request to call Kalustian Mr.? He'd always had problems with power figures, and now he had to deal with three of them at once. After the judge sustained another Ferreria objection, Hanlon switched to a new track. Question. To your knowledge, during the period of time that you knew Julius Butler, did you know that he protected himself and always carried a gun? Answer. I knew that during the time around the trial, he told me he carried a gun or had one for his protection. Question. Which one? That he always carried one or had one? Answer. What I remember him saying was when he owned the beauty shop, he had one close by. He might have. That's what I remember. I knew he carried a gun. I knew he had a gun. Question. And back in 1972, was it legal to carry a gun in Los Angeles County without a license, regardless of your status as a felon and non-felon? Answer. I believe not. Question. Were you aware of the fact that prior to Mr. Butler's testifying for you, not you personally, but for your office, that he was violating the law regardless of his status of felon or non-felon by carrying a gun? Answer. One has to come to that conclusion. Question. What, if anything, did you do about that? Answer. Like, report it to the police? Question. I'm asking you, Judge. Answer. Not a thing. Question. Okay, so you felt, and correct me if I am wrong, that under the circumstances of prosecuting the Panthers, protecting witnesses in that light was acceptable as an officer of the court for you to let a witness break the law? The judge sustained another Ferreria objection, and Hanlon asked, did you believe it was all right for Mr. Butler to violate the law? At the time, Kaloustian testified, speaking with the calm authority of someone who wore robes on the job, it seemed to me the man's life was in danger. The man has to decide how he is going to protect himself. I am not going to be the one that calls the police and tells them that he's got a gun and they strip him of his own protection that he thinks he needs. Hanlon asked if this attitude wasn't a breakdown of the law. Judge Dickey sustained another objection and ordered, go on to something else. After more questions, Hanlon tried to get Kaloustian to admit that he'd been aware of allegations of violence in Julius Butler's background. Question, were you aware that Mr. Butler owned or had control of a Thompson submachine gun as late as September of 1969? Answer, I don't think so, but I don't remember now whether I did or not. Question, are you aware the number of guns that Mr. Butler possessed? Answer, I don't think so. I don't know. Question, and did you consider Butler, when you knew him, to be a convicted felon or non-convicted felon? Answer, I thought he was a convicted felon. Question, so when you knew he was carrying a gun, you believed he was carrying it as an ex-felon? Ferreria, objection, misstates the evidence. Dickey, ex-felon? Hanlon, I am sorry. I misspoke, Your Honor. He was carrying as a felon. Dickey, ask another question. Kaloustian, I suppose the answer to that is I didn't think about it at the time. The answer is yes, I guess he was. For the second time in the examination, Hanlon addressed Kaloustian as Judge, and the witness responded, "You can call me Mister. I don't mind." Hanlon turned toward the bench, smiled, and said, "I want to do what the judge wants to do." Dickey warned, "Don't start that again." Soon, Hanlon and Ferreria were in acrimonious debate about the exact date when Kaloustian had asked that Butler's fine be reduced. "Well," Judge Dickey pointedly asked Hanlon, "don't you have a calendar?" "At the hotel," Hanlon said, "I don't have it with me. I am sorry." The judge said, "I hope we are not going to argue about things that we can easily look up." Hanlon asked Kaloustian if he recalled making a motion to remove certain allegations of violence, menace, and fraud, deceit, from Butler's conviction record, but in his increasingly flustered state, he said 1993 instead of 1973. The judge corrected him again. Kaloustian answered that he'd acted on Butler's behalf because they wouldn't let him into law school with the allegations of force and violence remaining in the information. Before Hanlon could frame his next question, he looked down at a note from Julie Drouse. "Stop. Say you're sick." Hanlon turned to the judge and said, "Your Honor, I know we intended to go to 4:30. I'm not feeling well, and we are not going to be done at 4:30. The judge seemed satisfied to cut the day short. Without waiting for further explanation, he said, "That is fine." Thank God, Hanlon said to himself, "Now I can go back to the hotel and stick my head in the toilet."
Context of white supremacy. We will pick up chapter Devil's Advocate once the second audio segment resumes. Number to dial if folks have thoughts, comments, questions to share, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. Let's see. Nab one of our emails and then we'll get to folks who dialed in. One of our investors wrote in, let's see, Julio under oath. Number one, Butler, I just felt sorry for him, Pratt said later. What a poor fool he was. Worse than an Uncle Tom. No name calling. Nothing I could do to Julio would be as hard as what he had to go through every time he looked in the mirror. Mother Butler. Such a useless, sad man. This is an interesting mix of name calling and contempt combined with empathy for Butler by Pratt, which is certainly understandable. I think this passage exemplifies the confused feelings of non-white victims towards other victims caused by the global system of racism, white supremacy. Absolutely. Usual suspects most to blame. 2 days, 2 minutes maybe of having to sit in a closet, basically, a cage, with armed guards and killers, and you're sleeping in your own waste and fed gruel and everything. You could have been killed repeatedly and all the rest of this. Like, man, I don't know how much empathy I'm going to have for anybody, victims, racists, anybody who in any way, shape, form participated in my being here. Probably be a whole lot of name calling too, but all of that said, just, you know, following the logic, it's what I keep trying to remember. Julio Butler, like, hey, he could have been in Geronimo Pratt's position. They got all those gun charges, like they could have switched it around, like, hey, you did, and we'll stick you with the tennis court murders. You don't want to help us, you know, set up Pratt and the rest of these no good Panthers, and we'll stick it all on you. Have fun. You know, you'll be the one sleeping in your waist. I mean, usual suspects, very important to keep in mind, but man, it would be rough. Next, Mr. Kaloustian. Number one, Kaloustian answered that he'd acted on Butler's behalf because they wouldn't let him into law school with the allegations of force and violence remaining in the information. In his long and illustrious career, I suspect Butler is the only non-white black who Kaloustian went out of his way to support being a lawyer. He didn't rattle off a long list of other black people that he had, you know, chipped in to help them do this, or, you know, get their life together, or loosened some charges, got something off of their record. Maybe he did that for lots of folks, but we didn't get that list at the trial. The rest of his commentary is in the second portion of the audio, so we'll get to that later. The email again, untiljustice@gmail.com. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Two quick things I wanted one is a question, but the other thing I want to share. The audio we heard at the very beginning, right? Johnny Cochran was speaking, the late, great Johnny L. Cochran Jr. He was speaking on Democracy Now! And he said that you look at, you know, things that are more current that happened after O.J. Simpson. He said, now look at the Rampart scandal. And he said, people are just like, oh, well, gee whiz, you know, they were gangsters. You know, you get what you get. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. These were not gangsters. These are corrupt police officers who just go in and say, oh, yeah, they're gangsters. We can do whatever they want to. They're gang members. Yeah, yeah, we got to, you know, frame them and do all kinds of other things. That's why I said all of this should be put together. I think I said that way back when we were reading O.J. Simpson. I said it would be Rodney King, the trial, subsequent riots, looting, whatever they want to call it, O.J. Simpson, Rampart, even Geronimo Pratt, put that in there since that trial, him finally being released, was in the 90s. All of that would be looked at together. And the assassination, notorious B.I.G., which happened in L.A., LAPD investigated, and even the assassination of Tupac Shakur. Like, all of that should be looked at together in context. Well, I keep saying the next book, Labyrinth. Johnny Cochran mentioning Rampart right there. It's probably a lot of people don't even know what that is. Like, Rampart? What is that? What does that have to do with the assassination of Tupac and Biggie Smalls and O.J. Simpson, Rodney King? What does that have to do with all that? Stay tuned. The question, now, last week, we went through the session and they talked about Stuart Hanlon, James McCloskey, Jim McCloskey. They all sit down, Pratt's white legal team, staffers and all. They sit down and they say, okay, should we keep Johnny Cochran on or do we need to let him go? Is he going to hurt our team? We might have a racist judge. That's what they say. We might have a racist judge. And, you know, he might say, I'll fix his ass, talking about Johnny Cochran. Remember that? They said he dresses all slick and is all slick talking and everything. Like, that might mess it up for our team. Might have somebody who wants to get us back. You know, you got that OJ off and everything. Now, if you paying attention to what we heard this week, Stuart Hanlon's performance with Judge Kaloustian on the stand, and they end up having to take a break so he can go and put his head in the toilet. Like, I put affirmative action in the description. Like, people who paid attention, you remember the section last week, they seriously contemplated booting Johnny Cochran off the team. And then even this week, they said, nah, Cochran, you got to sit this one out because you'll get upset, angry, uppity, and you'll just piss off the job. Let me handle it. I got it. For this, just a little contrast. I think that term was brought up sometime about a week or so ago. Contrast programming. Dr. Welsing talked about that frequently. Like, that is a contrast for you. The performance of Stuart Hanlon this week in contrast with Johnny Cochran almost being kicked off the team last week for being too slick and flashy. And OJ. If folks have any thoughts on that, take a moment to think about it. I would love to hear. *61, first few folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, feel free. And again, we are slowly, we might only have one more session left. Next week, we have to see. But I think we might be wrapping this one up next week and then pushing off to Labyrinth. So be thinking of final thoughts, summations for the text as well. But folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all callers and listeners. In the beginning of the chapter of Julio Under Oath, the first sentence basically lets you know how good Johnny Cochran is. Cochran stayed up until 4 a.m. preparing for questions. That right there is dedication. 4 a.m. I mean, who stays up until 4 a.m. perfecting their craft? And it also shows, too, with the deposition of him giving Butler those questions. And also, you know, contrasting to your question in regards to Hamlin's poor performance against Kalustian. So, and I wanted to get into that, too, because on page 404, he accused Cochran of being too angry. And I thought about, Hamlin probably practicing racism in that one. You know, obviously Cochran being the angry black man. So I thought about that as well. I also thought about Butler, being a minister, And I always thought about if that was intentional for him to do that, to kind of protect himself just in case, all of this stuff that he's done in the past kind of backfires, And it also seems to me that there's some of these ministers who are ex-officers are in that respect. So, I think about, some of the professions that, most serve the system of white supremacy, police officers and ministers. And you have a significant part of that population that kind of overlaps both in a way. So I kind of wonder if that was a conscious decision for him to do that, to hide his crimes of the past. The wording of him calling himself a mediator or liaison, that was very laughable. And when Cochran used the word semantic sophistry, I mean, this is the genius of Johnny Cochran and how he handles the media. I mean, obviously he could have just called, he could have just said liar, which, basically that's what that term means, or basically just saying, or what you would refer to buckets and buckets of words. But, he's so clever when he, handles the media. And then obviously it showed in the O.J. Simpson trial as well, on the way he handled the media in that case as well. So I'm guessing he's trying to use the same tactics of how he words things carefully and concisely. So but that's all I have on Meet My Lie.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Buckets and buckets of words, indeed. Johnny Cochran uses his thesaurus, got that alliteration going, semantic sophistry. We'll nab other folks as we go through and see hands. I want to make sure I get some of my notes in as well. Great point, the first sentence of the chapter. Not Johnny Cochran stayed up until 4 a.m. picking out, his most colorful, flashy threads. And he stayed up until 4 a.m. to trim his mustache just right and to make sure that he had the exact gator shoes matching with it. No. Stayed up until 4 a.m. preparing questions, not preparing to get up on the soapbox and talk. Same thing we talk about for neutralizing workplace racism and many other aspects of counter-racism. Questions. Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Let's see. Next in, this is all in Julio Under Oath, this chapter. And this, I mean, this whole hearing, I guess, so far seems so different, where the judge, Judge Dickey, is not sustaining all of the prosecution's objections, and folks are having to answer. Stand by. When Mr. Fuller say, stand by your work. Stand proud and tall of, you know, what you did, liaison or informant or whatever you want to call it. Stand by your work, what you did. Be accountable for, you know, what you did, so we can evaluate all of that. Let's see. But through the trial thus far, a totally different feel in terms of the prosecution just not getting a rubber stamp on everything that they would like to stop questioning. I love Johnny Cochran. He starts off asking a few questions about Butler's background to kind of remind the judge and get it on the record. This guy was a sheriff's deputy, so it's not like he was an idiot about the legal process or the law, firearm laws and all that. They would tend to go over that if you are someone who is a law enforcement officer who might be charged with carrying a gun and knowing that you're not supposed to have this firearm if you have a felony, as he did at the time of all this. And I think I made a point of that a couple of weeks back and saying, hey, they're saying Butler had a submachine gun and all these rounds of ammunition and what have you, whether that was to go and to conjure up some things with the Black Panther Party, to be an agent provocateur, as they say, to go and suggest some really wild and criminal activities that'll probably get some Panthers killed and justify increased police repression, or whatever, to go and do some sort of crime so you can blame it on another Black person, Geronimo Pratt type thing. But I said, man, how many in 1969, 1968, 1970, how easy would it be for a Black person to get a submachine gun? Right now, 2021, like, who here thinks I could obtain a submachine gun, you know, in, give me a week and it's here. You know, pandemic might slow things down, the mails run a little slow, but oh yeah, give me a week and it's mine. It would take me some time, so just that alone, like, man, and this guy's got a felony and all the rest of it, like, oh my God, like, this should be standing out to anybody. Like, I don't know how he got 3,500 church members to be like, we love us some, you know, Mama Butler, he is the best, and we don't think he did anything wrong to Mr. Pratt. Like, I don't know how he got all that together, but wow. I guess while there to the question, that is an interesting point. Did he, Butler, take that position at the church to kind of disguise himself, some sort of, hey, this is a safe haven, sanctuary, if you will, for me here at the church. Nobody will suspect me. I'm at the church every Sunday on the deacon board or whatever else it is. And or he was at a big congregation. It's not like he went to some, you know, little small 40 member congregation. They said he had like 3,500. I think it was just Black males. So we had not even got to all the Black ladies with their beautiful hats and everything at the church. So it sounds like he went to a monstrous size, when I say monstrous, like large, went to a enormous size congregation, one of those maybe mega churches. Like I said before, like, ooh, that could be continuing the COINTELPRO. Like, wow, that is a mighty network of Black people that you can keep an eye on, influence, report back on, have tabs. Like, it could be both, you know, it could be multiple roles. You can get a great way to kind of further disguise yourself, distance from all of your past wrongdoings, and maybe even keep up the work in spying on Black people. Maybe something to think about. Continuing. Let's see. And now they said the same thing, not only with the church, they said when he got on the stand, he had his tailored suit and used all kinds of legal jargon to wow and impress court spectators and such. That, oh, wait, there's no way this guy lied and did all of this stuff and framed Geronimo Pratt. Let's see. I guess if anybody can think of any other times where white people have done this, helped expunge things from the records of a Black person, I think William O'Neill, the same might apply. He was one of the Black people who helped in the assassination of Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, in Chicago. I think he might have got some similar goodies, hookups from white people along the way. Let's see. Mm-mm. Let's see. Next. When he goes through, okay, so he goes to the submachine gun. I just talked about that. I don't think, well, I think I would have difficulty in getting it now. And then he tells the FBI that Geronimo Pratt owned this machine gun, and he says that Eldridge Cleaver has a rocket launcher and a 50 caliber machine gun, which is mounted on a truck. Now, I mean, you can rewind, same question I asked before. Who here thinks that they could get their hands on a rocket launcher, like, before the end of the year and not end up being labeled a black identity extremist? Much less, you know, any of the rest. I mean, it's just, are you serious? Like, who would even, how would you even get any of the, in 1969, no less, how would you get this on Craigslist? Like, what are you talking about? Like, and Eldridge Cleaver, who I believe was a felon by 1969, we're not reading Soul on Ice right now, so I might not have all my facts and figures on Mr. Cleaver, but I believe he had already been to prison. I think he wrote Soul on Ice in prison, so I think he was a convicted felon by 1969. How in the world would a convicted felon have a 50 caliber submachine gun mounted on a truck? How is that possible? And white people don't know this, for an organization that they have thoroughly infiltrated, tapped, wired, surveillance, anything you can think of, they have all of this, and white people don't know this, and they have to depend on Mama Butler to tell? Like, come on, come on. Not believable at all. Oh, my God. Let's see. The clothing, now, you know, we've heard a lot of interesting testimony, important testimony throughout all this reading, racism, COINTELPRO, blah, blah, blah. Seemingly innocuous, right? Pratt is, Geronimo Pratt is, you know, complaining, I don't like this suit that I guess Ebony Magazine hooked me up with, and I don't like it. I don't, you know, wear suits and ties and stuff. This is not my style. I want to wear something, you know, like what I wore, the polyester suit that I wore when I got arrested in Dallas 25 years ago. And there's a song, probably many of them, called Suspended in Time, and it is about black people generally being placed in greater confinement and kind of just being lost. People have talked about it. I just mentioned the song, but people have talked about it where they, you know, got locked up, let's say, take this, 1970, sometime in there. And then by the time they get released, it's a totally different world. Like, people are not wearing the same clothes. You got Craigslist and all the, even going to get gas. They were talking just basic things. Like, the gas station in 1970 is way different from the gas station in 2020. And they talked about people who, you know, been locked up for that decades type of a thing and going to the gas station and just feeling like a Neanderthal. Like, whoa, what is going on here? Like, and I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, it's just like small things like that in terms of how much you lose. You're not in touch with anything, much less your family. Like, you go into greater confinement. Like, he had children in greater confinement. They talked about now they're 16. Like, you missed their entire childhood. You know, so much has changed, much less all the fashion changes and everything else. And parents are elderly. And he said he missed all of his, he in Democracy Now, right? He said in the interview, he said, man, I missed like half of my 20s, all of my 30s, all of my 40s. That's like your prime years of your life. I'm in greater confinement and in solitary for most of that, eating gruel and hoping I don't get killed for a crime I didn't even commit. As a two-tour Vietnam veteran going into Memorial Day weekend. Let's see. Don't even know what clothes to wear, man. Now, they lynched Geronimo Pratt's brother, Tim. He's watching the Butler testimony. He says he said, in essence, Butler was the prince of evil. BGQ certainly victims guaranteed qualified. For sure. But man, I just feel like it's so easy. What Geronimo Pratt said. He said, we're so quick to judge. I take exactly the legend. He said it beautifully. Geronimo Pratt is so easy. We can make a judgment of these folks who were, you know, right there being attacked and everything. Like I said, it could have been Julio Butler. Not that I'm saying what he did is correct and all the rest of it is terrible. Terrible. I'm just saying it's real easy to slap a label on a Julio Butler. It's a prince of evil. Or William O'Neill, prince of evil. Again, that's the black male, same role in Chicago, assassination of Mark Clark, Fred Hampton. I don't hear people as often say the prince of evil is M. Wesley Swearingen. right? Somebody white. I don't hear that. It won't be some of these other white people. All of the bosses of these different black people who were snitches, informants, liaisons, what do you want to call them? I don't hear that generally. I don't hear people going around and saying that, oh man, this Calustian fellow, prince of evil, other than Johnny Cochran, he was pretty outspoken, but I don't hear people doing that. If we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, then the princes, the princesses, the kings, queens of evil, all of the folks who would be most to blame for this cannot be William O'Neill and Julius Butler. Just trying to follow logic. Let's see. Okay, so, and then Butler loses something. He gets riled up. Johnny Cochran is amazing as an attorney. They said Butler came in, he has his polished, tailored suits on. He's got his glasses and using his litigator jargon to impress anybody. And by the time Johnny Cochran gets through with him, they said he gets to talking about Long John Washington as someone who wouldn't have the balls. Cochran had to interrupt him. Whoa, we're in court. Watch your language. Like, man, you're supposed to be trying to convince us that, you know, you're professorial and you would not dare stoop to these levels. And now you're sounding, you know, less than that substantially. The brilliant Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Let's see. Yeah, all of his assessment to me just comes across as not believable at all. We'll have to see how the judge interpreted all that. Let's see. And so then we get this brilliance from Johnny Cochran with Julio Butler on the stand. And then it switches. And then I think Henry in Chicago had already pointed out. They say, oh, man, I don't know, Mr. Cochran. You're going to be upset. Can't keep your emotions in check. You're just this angry black fella. Get up here and wild out, you know. Can't do that or risk, you know, people thinking that you're still with OJ and all the rest of it. So I'll do it. Let me handle this. Even though Cochran is way more experienced, just run attorney of the year and all the rest of it. And man, I got it. And then to get this, where he goes in and then he tries to blame it. He says, I'm going to blame it on the NAACP council for getting up and asking this goofiness about, we don't want to call him judge. You know, we just want to continue calling him Mr. Calusti, and to say that his cockamamie question, I had to stop and look that up. I've heard people use it before to just mean like goofy, nonsensical, silly. That's the context that I've heard it used before, but just I had no idea, like the etymology, like where did this word come from? What does it mean? Like all of that. I had to stop and look even just the sounding of the word, since we've talked so much about homoeroticism, like, wow, cockamamie. Using that to kind of castigate the NAACP representation, and then even saying that they participated in fouling him up and going to question Calusti in this first round. Right on, and his nickname, Stuart Hanlon, Rumpled of the Bailey. And I would even pause right there. Now, we got this performance right for this chapter. This guy has been snorting coke, filing briefs late. His nickname is Rumpled of the Bailey because he does not have that problem like Johnny Cochran of coming to court all flashy and stylish and, ooh, look at my t-. No. He comes to court looking like some ruffian, some bum. Nickname Rumpled of the Bailey. As I said, filing brief late. And he lied. We started off the book. He lied to even get in to see Geronimo Pratt. He wasn't even an attorney at the time. I mean, he just has not impressed me as a litigator throughout this book. I've just been like, wow, this guy is kind of lame. Like, remember he said a couple chapters back, he said, my greatest contribution to the defense might be that I added McCloskey and some of these other litigators. Not that I came up with a great strategy or filed a brief on time or not even came to court in a nice new suit. Iron, no wrinkles, nope. And then we get this, like, wow. I wrote in the white affirmative action. Johnny Cochran is almost booted off the team, and this is what we're left with if they had booted him off. Like, are you serious? Let's see. All of this is, I think, the first time since we've had Judge Dickey, where now all of the prosecution's objections are being sustained. Vague question. We talk about that on the program and encounter racism in general, the importance of asking great questions, refining your questions, getting better at asking questions. Didn't sound like Stuart Hanlon stayed up until 4 a.m. and came up with a great strategy and set of questions to handle Mr. Calusi. And it did not sound like that at all. Let's see. Let's make sure we get in. Also thought it was important when they go through this exchange about Calustian being aware that Julio Butler had a firearm at the time of the trial and that this was a felon, that that's against the law. He was supposed to support it or do something. This is not supposed to be happening, a felon with a firearm. And he says, look, and he's with the authority of a white man who wears a robe daily. And look, his life was threatened probably by some niggers. And if he decides he has to have a firearm to protect himself, who am I to say that he can't do that? Now, I thought, now, wow, talk about discretion. We talk about that word all the time, but white people have discretion. I guess to some people that may sound logical. To me, it does not. Especially you talk about, hey, they threw Geronimo Pratt's attorneys out over potato chips. Not a firearm, potato chips. Now you're telling me a felon? Who's running around with these rabble-rousing Panthers, and he's got a submachine gun and all these other weapons and whatever else, and it's, hey, you got to do what you got to do to protect yourself. Yeah. Let's see. He doesn't know about the cars, lots of ignorance, and then they stop it so he can be sick. Like I said, white affirmative action, like, wow. He goes to stick his head in the toilet. Like, you were the guy that was contemplating maybe we should get rid of Johnny Cochran? Like, really? Head in the toilet? Rumpled of the Bailey? You were going to kick John? Even contemplating, would we be better served by not having Johnny Cochran with us in court? Woo! White affirmative action is amazing. Let's see. For the folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody. Yeah, I was just thinking about the first report as you were reciting it, and I was thinking along the lines that the individuals that are called snitches, rats, Uncle Toms, and whatnot, in that particular opportunity is not commonly volunteered by the person. It is a very shrewd practice that the controlling facility does to be able to recruit such people. Normally, they find something on them. It's like almost like holding that person hostage. Okay, look, we know that you were arrested in Detroit for Grand Theft Auto. And if you want to see it going through, then that's fine and good. But if you can come and help us with this, with this particular situation, then we may be able to do something about your situation, you know, that sort of thing. That's quite common. With the art, I believe it's called espionage. White people are experts at it. They even teach each other to mistreat your ally in order to get the information that's needed. That sort of thing. As far as what they trained that person on, and the Black Panther Party was extensively infiltrated on that level. With the weapons that was talked about, Thompson handheld machine gun was a legendary weapon. Very few people have that in their private possession. It's no longer used by the military, and by that time, it wasn't used by the U.S. military. But all of those firearms that the switch that you can turn from semi-automatic to automatic, you're not going to get that out of Walgreens or Walmart. You're not, you know, you have to know somebody in order to get that, and that got a white person written all over it as far as this distribution of such arms. And that 50 caliber, that weapon is almost 100 years old. But it's so proficient, it still is used by the United States military today. Its firepower operates almost like artillery, although it doesn't fire explosive rounds necessarily. It does in some cases, but it's not really artillery. But the rounds are so big that it actually can go through and tear up concrete. And that weapon is almost 100 years old and is so proficient, it's still used today. You can't even carry it and use it. You can't operate it by carrying it. It has to go up on a stand. That's why they said that they had it mounted on a truck or something like that, they said, something like that. That has a white person written all over it. And there also was a, quote-unquote, what they call, it's not a racial classification, but it's called an Asian person. I can't think of his name. That was the middle person in getting the Black Panther Party weapons. And people found out later on that most, if not all, of those weapons were dysfunctional. Were dysfunctional. You know, and the rocket launcher. I mean, all of those, that and the 50 caliber are weapons that are used from a distance, a long distance. You know, and a white person has to be a part of that transition for someone like the Black Panther Party to be able to get alone. I know they didn't use them, but to even get such weapons, you know, it's hard to obtain, you know, from that standpoint. And those are just my observations of what I was hearing in the first read. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. That's about what I thought. I wasn't alive at that time, but I know I would have some difficulty acquiring such a firearm right now, 2021, and I have a smartphone, several laptop computers, fast Wi-Fi. I know some white people, and I still think it would probably be difficult. If you put me on the clock, like, gotta have this by the end of the year, like, oof. We'll have to see. And as for the so-called Asian male, Richard Aoki, Aoki is the spelling of his last name. Richard Aoki,
yeah,
non-white so-called Asian male who lots of, like, NPR, many outlets have talked about. Yikes, looks like this fella might have been an informant as well with supplying guns. And there are also many reports that Marlon Brando, Godfather, or any other of the picks that you want to pick out, who provided firearms to the Panthers, that I guess you could say is funny, but it's not really funny because a lot of people died, that a lot of these firearms, as he just said, didn't work. So, yeah, just lots to process all the way around. Other folks that we missed totally have commentary. They want to make sure they get in before we get to the second audio segment.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Thank you for the program. Just a couple of things. Snitches or informants usually are, it's not uncommon. I'll say it that way. From my understanding, for these individuals to end up in that position, usually when potential informant is already, you know, having some sort of legal hardships, usually some sort of a conflict with the law. It's not as simple as, hey, you know, you just bump into someone off the street and say, hey, you want to make some money and you develop a relationship. It's usually it's either that informant will be punished. In order for them to save themselves, they have to bring someone else it's usually that the person who's acquiring the informant would like to have someone else and use that person to do it. With that being said, Julio Butler is a victim in that regard. I would say a confused victim, but a victim nonetheless. As far as Hanlon being incompetent, like just a drug addict, a degenerate, a disorganized, a fro. If his racial classification wasn't so prominent, like this would be the way that I believe a white person would describe a black person. if they weren't trying to just use stereotypes and, you know, unappealing information, Hanlon would foot the bill, Afro included. As far as I myself thought it was ironic that a person, I don't know if the judge, the witness that was a judge, was a practicing judge at the time, but the entire concept of a person who was a sitting judge in a courtroom stating, who am I to judge a criminal for doing a crime under oath, is just it's a feeling that I cannot find a word for. I don't want to say it's hilarious because it's not funny. I don't want to say it's preposterous because it seems like it occurred. It's just interesting, to say the very least. Thank you. I mean my line.
Good observation, Mo in Dallas. Indeed, white people. It's interesting. Individuals classified as white when they decide, hey, I'm not going to judge, because they seem to judge niggers harshly all the time, particularly when they're engaged in criminal activity, like a felon with a gun. Like, whoo, that's like two steps away from OJ, right? Like, man, not in this case, I reckon. We will.
It was a kid with a lemonade stand. They would call the cops.
Better business bureau better have all of your paperwork and all your other authorization, but a felon, a black male felon with a firearm, to each his own, you know, gotta have protection. Those niggers are dangerous, you know. You're gonna hang around with those Panthers, you need can't be emasculated. Right. There's difficult to find a word. Hypocritical doesn't quite get it as well. Like, yeah, it's definitely noteworthy, but it is difficult to even put a word on it. We will continue because it just gets better. And we are, at least in the book-wise, we are nearing the birthday of White Jesus. Remember, they had all that to do about the beginning of the trial. And, oh, man, it's almost Christmas Eve and all the rest of it. So White Jesus' birthday is also quickly approaching. So we're picking up Devil's Advocate. That's the next chapter, chapter 62. Yep, I'm not sure. Devil's Advocate, that's the next chapter we're picking up at. If you did not get to share, or if you had additional observations, questions that you wanted to pose, just make a note. We'll have ample time once the second segment concludes. Last Man Standing, Jack Olson, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment 2.
Chapter 64, Devil's Advocate. When Hanlon reached his suite at the Marriott, the red light was blinking on the message machine. Someone from the State Bar Association had called to suggest a referendum on Kaloustian's disbarment. Hanlon returned the call and said, "For Christ's sake, wait till the case is over. You'll just piss off our judge." The former Panther leader, Kathleen Cleaver, joined the other members of the team over a contentious pizza dinner in Hanlon's two-room command suite. "Everybody jumped my ass," he recalled later. Jim McCloskey, Julie, Cleaver, Garcia, our investigator, David Lynn, they all agreed I was blowing the Kaloustian examination. In a situation where the lawyer must dominate the witness, Hanlon had allowed the opposite to happen. As a career prosecutor and judge, Kaloustian was an expert on trial testimony. His calm, judicial demeanor had carried the day. All the pizza eaters agreed that it would be counterproductive to badger Kaloustian about Julius Butler's status as an informant. Nor would the former prosecutor ever concede that there'd been anything improper about his post-trial attempts to give the hairdresser a leg up in society. Indeed, Kaloustian could claim that his intercession had helped to convert a street thug into a lawyer, churchman, and African-American role model. Juliana Drouse advanced a devil's advocate proposition, her accustomed role. She'd been continuing her behind-the-scenes research, and a friend from the Los Angeles Public Defender's Office had advised her that, unlikely as it might sound, Kaloustian probably was telling the truth about being kept in the dark at the time of the original Pratt trial. He was a young DA in those days, she told her colleagues. He was handed the case on short notice. He'd been working outside LA, and this was one of his first downtown cases. They dumped it on the new kid on the block. It's quite possible that the cops and the DA's investigators held out on him. Drouse said she'd also learned that Kaloustian enjoyed a good reputation as a deputy DA. Even defense lawyers learned to like him, she told her colleagues. He was regarded as honorable, always opened his trial books to the defense, always provided full and fair discovery. My contact says we might be making a mistake putting horns on him. "Do you really believe that, Julie?" Hanlon asked. "I think it's possible." After the last wedge of pizza had disappeared and the lawyers had drained multiple carafes of coffee, they learned from Cochran by phone. It was plain that his opinion about Kaloustian was not subject to change. The guy put on perjured testimony, he insisted again to Hanlon. He knew Julio was a snitch from day one. "Do you think he could have been fooled by the cops and his investigators?" Hanlon asked. Cochran reminded him of a Julius Butler claim that he and Detective Morris Bowles had been personal friends and drinking companions. Say Bowles knew that Julio was an informer, Cochran said. Then he sits next to Kaloustian all through the trial and never says a word? He hears Julio deny under oath that he ever snitched, and he doesn't nudge Kaloustian and say, "Hey, we got a little problem here." and Kalustian never asks? Cochran hesitated. Maybe I'm prejudiced, Stu. Maybe I can't get over all the years that I hated Dick Kalustian for what he did to Pratt. Hanlon put down the phone and thought, Johnny's a hard man, but he's usually right. Is he right this time? Geronimo's freedom could depend on the answer. He lit a forbidden cigarette and took a walk around the courtyard. He knew that he'd been bested in court and didn't intend to be bested again. This hearing is our last chance, he said to himself. We can't keep fighting the system forever. He re-entered his suite just as McCloskey was saying, Why do we have to make Kalustian admit anything? We don't need his testimony that Butler was an informer. We can prove it with other people. We can prove it with documents, and Julio as much as admitted it himself. Drouse said, Stu, Judge Dickey will not let us embarrass Kalustian. And Jim's right. It isn't necessary. The real issue is, if Kalustian had known that Julio was an informer, would he and should he have told Johnny in discovery? And would he and should he have allowed it to come out at trial? And if it had come out, McCloskey said, would Geronimo have been convicted? I think we know the answer to that. Everyone except Hanlon accepted the new theory with only minor variations. In his mind, he clung to visions of a high noon drama with a shame-faced Kalustian forced to admit every malfeasance, real and imagined. Judge Dickey would slam down his gavel and the case would be over. But he also realized that this wasn't TV or Hollywood, and it didn't matter whether Stuart Douglas Hanlon was right or wrong, or whether this trial strategy was flawed, or whether he looked like a hero or a fool. All that mattered was keeping Geronimo Pratt from spending the rest of his life in prison. After a while, he thought, we can't win by alienating any more judges. We've made enemies all the way up to the Supreme Court. We don't need one more. Just before midnight, he said, God damn it, guys, you're right. He threw out the questions he'd prepared for the next day and began reworking his plan. Chapter 65, Kinder and Gentler. A few minutes before the start of the Friday, December 20 session, the bleary-eyed Hanlon walked into the courtroom looking even more disheveled than usual. He hadn't felt so beleaguered since the Columbia campus riots 30 years earlier. A single figure sat alone on a front bench. Hanlon had taken two or three steps past the man when he realized that it was Kalustian. On impulse, he turned. His opponent looked up and smiled. Without thinking, the king of the schmooze took a seat beside him. You know, Judge, he said, for 20 years you've been a paper tiger to me. I never met you, and I didn't know you till yesterday. We got off to a bad start. I was sullen and rude, and I want to apologize. He held out his hand, and Kalustian shook it. To Hanlon, the ex-prosecutor looked almost relieved. He asked if he could call Hanlon Stewart. Of course. Geronimo Pratt's prosecutor sounded sincere and polite. He said he understood what had happened in the courtroom the day before and that he respected Hanlon for representing his client aggressively. I respect you too, Hanlon said. Let's get through this thing as gentlemen. When Everett Dickey beckoned his judicial colleague to the stand to resume his testimony, Hanlon turned toward Kaloustian and said, "Good morning, Judge." After a few warm-up questions, Hanlon signaled his kinder and gentler approach by asking, "I assume that as a district attorney, your job was to prosecute the case in court and not necessarily to do the investigation or gather the information." "That's right," Kaloustian replied. "Question, and you indicated yesterday that Maury Bowles in your own office helped you in some sense in the investigation. Was that not true?" "Answer, he was from the Bureau. He did what I asked him to do. I'm not that sure how much investigation there was left to do at that point." "Question, okay. And do you remember which police officers of the LAPD aided you in the investigation once you got involved in the case?" "Answer, Ray Callahan." "Question, okay, I want to ask you some questions, and obviously we're going back in time. If you don't remember, you don't remember. Did you ever have any investigator or law enforcement person to check the intelligence files of the Los Angeles District Attorney's Bureau of Investigation on, first of all, any matters regarding this trial?" "Answer, I don't remember." "Question, so if I asked if you particularly asked them about Butler, Pratt, or the party, your answer would be you don't remember also?" "Answer, I don't remember." "Question, okay. Did you or do you remember asking anybody to check the LAPD criminal conspiracy section files, assuming they had something on Mr. Pratt, Mr. Butler, or the Black Panther Party?" "Answer, I don't remember." "Question, do you know if you instructed anybody to review the Los Angeles Sheriff's file, if any existed, on Julio Butler, former employee of the Sheriff's Department?" "Answer, I don't think I did." "Question, okay, do you know if you asked anybody to run what is known as a CI rap sheet on Mr. Butler?" "Answer, I didn't. I don't remember having done that. I think we may have had one." "Question, do you have any memory of whether or not Mr. Maury Bowles told you that he had any type of relationship with Mr. Butler other than as an investigator on the case for you?" "Answer, I don't remember his telling me anything about any relationship with Butler." By declining to challenge Kaloustian's claims of lost memory, Hanlon was trying to signal to the judge on the witness stand and the judge on the bench that he was recasting himself and Kaloustian as honorable men who might disagree but were trying to get at the truth. Brentford Ferreria squirmed a little more than usual, but Judge Dickey seemed pleased with the new approach. It was consistent with his original instructions. Hanlon continued, "Did anybody in the Bureau of Investigation of the District Attorney's Office give you any information that Julio Butler was considered an informant? Answer, no. Question, did Clayton Anderson tell you that he believed Julio Butler to be an informant for the FBI and or the LAPD? Answer, no. Question, would it be fair to say that you relied on the law enforcement agencies to provide you any background information you had other than your own interviews on Julio Butler? Answer, yes. Question, okay. Were you aware that the Bureau of Investigation kept intelligence files back at that time period? Answer, I didn't think much about it. I came from Long Beach and Torrance, and there was no intelligence out there. When I got to the Bureau, I got into organized crime. There was an intelligence section of the Bureau of Investigation, but it never... The fact that it kept intelligence files wasn't part of my consciousness. I never even thought about it. Question. Now, could you tell us your procedure, if you remember it, in this case or in other cases in terms of keeping your trial notebook? Answer, I didn't have a procedure. Question, okay, was this the first? Answer, probably the first case I ever tried where I didn't get the file 5 minutes before the trial and read the police reports on my way into court. Question, would you like any water, Judge? Answer, do you have some? Question, I think there's some here. Yes. The courteous colloquy occupied most of the morning session during a discussion about Kaloustian's pre-trial interviews in 1972, the former prosecutor even came to Hanlon's aid. In a firm voice, Judge Dickey had admonished Hanlon, unless this witness has some recollection of the interviews, this is wasting time. Kaloustian volunteered, I have some recollection. Dickey said, oh, well, I misunderstood. That's the only reason I'm asking him, Judge, Hanlon said pleasantly. Whenever he came to a subject that might embarrass Kaloustian, Hanlon tried not to word his question as a challenge. Still, there were certain matters that had to be placed on the record. It took Hanlon several minutes to lead up to asking why Kaloustian had told a witness in the Pratt trial that the FBI has never been involved in this case, and you know it. After a long intervention by Judge Dickey about whether Kaloustian had intended his FBI comment as a statement or a question, Hanlon asked, why did you make this statement, if you remember? Do you have an independent recollection? Kaloustian seemed to pick up on the cues from Hanlon and the judge. I don't have any independent recollection why I made that statement. It was actually a question, I think. I intended it to be a question at the time. I'm not sure. Late in the morning, Hanlon came to the new set of questions that he'd drawn up the night before. He began with a gentle preface. If you can't answer these, or if I can't ask a proper question, then obviously you won't have to answer them. But, he hesitated, if you had known in the period of time when you got the case until you went to trial that Julio Butler was passing information, talking to, giving information to the FBI, is that the type of information that you would have disclosed to the defense as bearing on the credibility of Mr. Butler? Ferreria apparently saw where Hanlon was heading and objected, calls for speculation, it's vague. Judge Dickey advised Hanlon to break it down. You can ask him two questions separately. Hanlon rephrased, "If you had been aware that Mr. Butler had given information about Elmer Pratt in December of 1969 about him possessing an illegal weapon and had passed that on to the FBI, is that information that you believe you would have disclosed to the defense?" Without hesitation, Kaloustian answered, "Yes." Hanlon continued the crucial sequence. Question: if you had known that, or if you had evidence that Julio Butler acted as a confidential informant against the Black Panther Party prior to Mr. Pratt's trial, is that information you would have disclosed to the defense? Answer: yes. Question: if you had known that an investigator in your office, Maury Bowles, had given Mr. Butler $200 to buy a gun prior to his testimony in this case and after grand jury testimony, would you have disclosed that evidence to the defense? Answer: assuming there was a connection between it and the case, assuming it could be inferred that it was a reward of some kind for testifying or some kind of a deal that was cut, I probably would, out of an abundance of caution. Question: if you had knowledge that your own Bureau of Investigation maintained as of January 1972 in a confidential informant index box a confidential informant index card listing Julio Butler as a CI with his investigator handler Maury Bowles, would you have turned that information over to the defense? Answer: yes. Question: if you had known that police officer Ed Henry considered Mr. Butler an informant for him prior to the delivery of the letter in August of 1969, is that information you would have turned over to the defense? Answer: if I determined that he was acting as an informant for Henry, yes. Question: if you had known Butler was meeting with the FBI, that information alone, is that something you would have passed on to the defense? Answer: something I would have looked into to find out what the meetings were about. Question: if you had known that Sergeant Rice believed Mr. Butler to be cooperating with the LAPD in 1969, is that information you would either have investigated or turned over to the defense? Ferreria: objection. That's vague. Dickey: overruled. Answer: I would have. Question: would you, if you had known that 3 days after the delivery of the letter, Mr. Butler told an agent of the FBI that he had given a letter to a friend of his that could put Black Panther Party members in the gas chamber, would you have considered that an important fact in the case? Answer: if at the time it appeared that he had an axe to grind, it should have been revealed. Hanlon was more than satisfied with the testimony. The Pratt team had scored its most important points since Julius Butler's reluctant admission that he'd been a subspecies of informant. By getting Kaloustian to agree that he would have provided the defense with exculpatory evidence that now was known to exist, he confirmed that Pratt was denied a fair trial. The man who'd sent Geronimo to prison was firmly on the record that Johnny Cochran had been denied evidence that could have led to a different verdict. In advancing his own image as an honest prosecutor who wanted to do the right thing, Kaloustian had helped to make the case for a writ of habeas corpus and a new trial. And he'd made it as a sitting judge himself. but would the other sitting judge see it that way? Chapter 66, A Lawyer's Dream. Most members of the defense team intended to spend the weekend before Christmas working on the case in the hotel in Irvine. Key witnesses remained to be examined: Morris Bowles, Dwayne Rice, Captain Ed Henry, and others. And strategies had to be blocked out. All agreed that the hearing seemed to be going well, but Hanlon exhorted his colleagues, "The only way we're going to win is if we nail down every point, no exceptions, no loopholes. Our case has to be so overwhelming that the judge and the appeals courts have no choice." On Saturday morning, the day after the long session with Kaloustian, the Marriott cashier called Hanlon to report that the rent was overdue on his suite and the single rooms of Drouse, Garcia, McCloskey, and Investigator Lynn. The bill was running at $1,000 a day, and the team's exchequer was empty. Hanlon started to call McCloskey, but Centurion Ministries ran on a tight budget, and several of the lay minister's angels had already shelled out heavily for travel, legal and hotel expenses, plus the salary of the private investigator. Hanlon was reluctant to abuse their generosity. A notorious check grabber saved the day by volunteering his own American Express Platinum card. Hanlon paid the bill with the card and told the cashier to retain the imprint. Before the hearing was over, Johnny Cochran would be billed another $8,000. Everyone laughed about it later. In the defense of Geronimo Pratt, money had never been an issue. Hanlon missed Kathy and his sons, but he was pinned to the Marriott for the weekend. Rory and Liam were in school, and during their Christmas vacation, Kathy intended to clear her court calendar and accompany them to Orange County to watch their father in action. In a way, Hanlon was glad to avoid the round-trip flight to San Francisco. He was a shadow co-pilot who used the armrests to assist on all takeoffs and landings. In his dreams, he saw great apes shaking his plane and slamming it to the ground. In lightning storms, he lowered the window shades and ducked under pillows to avoid the gorillas. Julie Drouse, wife, mother, and attorney, summed up the mood of the Pratt legal team as Christmas approached. "All we did was bitch about being away from our families. Woe is me. How'd I get into this situation? What are my poor kids doing without me?" The truth was, we were thrilled and excited. The case was going well, a defense lawyer's dream. It was Man of La Mancha, To Kill a Mockingbird. We were righting a terrible wrong. We kept making all these noises about being stuck in Orange County with John Wayne and the Nixon sucks, but we loved every second. Everyone except the client. Separated from his supporters, Pratt felt bereft and neglected. His lawyers met with him in the holding cell whenever court recessed, but the quarters were tight and his comments tended to get lost in the legal verbiage. He wanted his friend Kathleen Cleaver, now a visiting law professor at the Cardoza School of Law in New York, to sit at the petitioner's table, but Hanlon insisted there was no room. "She's been on my side since 1970, Geronimo pleaded. "She deserves a little recognition. "This hearing isn't about recognition, Hanlon replied. It's about getting you out of prison. We only have so much space. Pratt had never felt relaxed in the stiffly formal Orange County Jail. He was housed next to the multiple murderer, Charles Nigg, who kept explaining to anyone who would listen that it was his partner who committed his crimes. Look, man, Geronimo told him, I don't want to hear about it, okay? I got other things on my mind. Most of the time, he was simply lonely. At the end of each courtroom day, he was hustled away in handcuffs, while his lawyers and friends joined together for tete-a-tetes in the hall, swims and hot tubs at the hotel, convivial meals and bowl sessions. Above all else, he was a social animal, and he hated to miss the action. He was grateful for a few touches of kindness from the judge. Despite Dickey's formal courtroom decorum, he allowed the Pratt attorneys to eat takeout food in the courtroom at lunchtime. It meant a big savings in time for the out-of-towners. Each day, Robert Garcia or one of the other lawyers would carry Geronimo's portion to the holding cell alongside the courtroom and join him for a working lunch. When the judge let us bring food into the courtroom, Cochran said later, I was touched. Nothing like that would ever have happened at the Simpson trial. We tried to smuggle O.J. a pastrami sandwich, and the deputy acted like we were bringing in an assault rifle. We were warned if we did it again, we'd all go to jail. Folks said Judge Dickey was stiff. I just thought he was humane. In an oblique way, the judge's reasonableness put an unexpected stress on Geronimo and his lawyers. We were never gonna get another chance like this, said Hanlon, who found himself described in the Los Angeles Times as half mensch and half leprechaun. If we lost in front of a judge who was this fair and this conscientious, we were finished. Geronimo would die in prison. He knew it, and so did we. The judges who'd screwed us in the past left big openings for appeal, but Judge Dickey wasn't giving us a whiff of reversible error. We had to work our asses off to make sure we made no mistakes on our own. This didn't leave much time for schmoozing with Geronimo. Hanlon steeled himself to take a certain amount of abuse from his old friend. G was on edge all the time. Another guy would have cracked years earlier, knowing every hour of every day that he was innocent. I wasn't sure he was going to make it through the hearing. He was always getting pissed at one thing or another, and I was the one he complained to. It reached the point where I didn't want to deal with him anymore. I thought, I'll fight for you, but that's it. I had to face the fact that our relationship was coming to an end. All those years. I thought, if we get him out, he'll go one way and I'll go another. It was a sad thought. I loved Geronimo for so long. He was never just another client to me. Thank God for Kathy. I phoned her and the boys every night, and every night she told me not to worry. She said G and I would be friends again. I asked her how she knew. She said, who else would put up with such assholes? On Monday, the eve of Christmas Eve, and the sixth day of the hearing, Julius Carl Butler was ushered back to the witness stand for cross-examination by Brentford Ferreira. Cochran intended to conduct the redirect, and he filled several yellow pages with notes as it became clear that the churchman planned a major revision of his personal history. The latest version began with a setup question by Ferreria. Last week, I believe you testified to the following definition of an informant: someone who gives information about someone or someone who causes another to be arrested or convicted. Do you recall that? Yes, sir. The deputy DA held up a page from the trial transcript and said, "Now a question is asked. Could you dispute the connotation that you're in fact an informant?" And the answer states, "No, I was acting as an informant. Do you recall making that statement last week?" "Yes, sir. It's probably a misstatement that I made." Cochran jumped up. "Just a moment, Your Honor. Just a moment. The record speaks for itself." The judge said, "The witness can correct it if he feels that he said something erroneously last week." After more friction between the lawyers, Ferreria asked Butler, "Did you make this statement?" "No, I was acting as an informant." "If I did," Butler repeated, "it was a misstatement. My intention was..." "No, I was not an informant." The bizarre cross-examination ended with Ferreria asking if the witness had ever been paid as an informant by the DA's office. "No, sir." Asked and answered, Cochran said. The judge granted his motion to strike the response. During a recess, Cochran told a Los Angeles Times reporter, "Butler has this real problem with memory. He admits last week that he was an informant. He comes back and says he was wrong. I didn't mean to say that. We're just trying to show just how improbable he is." Cochran thought, half of Geronimo's life has been stolen by lies and liars. Sensitive antennae made him suspect that Butler had been coached. There was a fine line between trial prep and subordination of perjury. He wondered if his old friends Ferreria and Sondheim had crossed it. Back in court, he decided to explore the possibility. "Now, over this weekend," he asked Butler, "did you spend quite a bit of time with Mr. Ferreria and Mr. Sondheim preparing for your testimony here today?" Answer, "No." Question, "Well, how much time did you spend with them?" Answer, "I spent some time this morning." Question, "Did you spend any time with the prosecutors over this weekend, either over the phone or in person?" Answer, "Over the phone, yes." Question, "What day was that?" Answer, "Sunday." Question, "What time was it on Sunday?" Answer, "Around 5 or 4 o'clock. Question, "And where did this phone conversation take place, sir?" Answer, "They called my home." Question, "When you say they, who do you mean?" Answer, "Mr. Brent, Mr. Ferraria." Question, "And also Mr. Sondheim." Answer, "I understand he was there." Question, "And then in the course, you had a conversation, did you? Answer, it was a question and answer, not a conversation. Judge Dickey interrupted his note-taking, turned toward Butler, and said, "Wait a minute. Do you realize what you just said, sir? He gave you the questions and the answers?" Apparently, the specter of subordination was also on the judge's mind. A prosecutor who spoon-fed a key witness specific questions and answers would be violating legal canons. Butler quickly responded, "No." The judge said, "I think you need to listen to the questions carefully. I don't think Mr. Cochran asked that to trick you. Are you really saying that he gave you questions and answers?" "No, sir, no." "Well, just listen to the question." Ferreria asked, "Could we perhaps have that part read back? I thought he said we engaged in questions and answers." Butler said, "That's what I thought I said." The judge said, "It's all done now. Go ahead, Mr. Cochran." Seated in the front row, the Reverend Jim McCloskey was impressed with Cochran's aplomb. "Johnny turns every courtroom into his personal stage," he said later. "He's Leonard Bernstein conducting his orchestra." "All right," Cochran continued in his sharp voice. "So that we're clear, nobody wanted to trick anybody here. Mr. Ferreria called you on Sunday afternoon, and the two of you then talked back and forth. Is that right?" "Objection," the prosecutor said. "Misstates what occurred. He said Mr. Sondheim was there too." The judge looked impatient and asked Butler, "Did you talk to Mr. Sondheim also?" Butler answered, "I think maybe saying hi, but I think I knew he was on the other end. That's basically all Mr. Sondheim did." Dickey overruled Ferreria's objection and ordered Cochran to continue. "Question. Were there any questions propounded to you by Mr. Ferreria?" Answer, "Yes, sir." Question. "He told you, did he not, what he was going to ask in court here today?" Answer, "No, sir." Question. "Did he ask you a series of questions, sir?" Answer, "Yes, sir." Question. "And then you tried to answer those questions?" Answer, "Yes, sir." Question. "How long did this question and answer session go on between you and Mr. Ferreria?" Answer, "Probably around an hour, somewhere." Question, "So it felt like from 4 to 5 he was firing these questions at you, right?" Ferreria took exception to the phraseology. "Well," Cochran said, "I'll take firing out." "You know, from today, counsel," Ferreria said, "I don't fire questions." Cochran said, "So stipulated, Your Honor." Both lawyers apologized to the judge for the byplay. Then Cochran continued his attempt to suggest that there'd been an unusual amount of trial prep over the weekend. Question. "And you answered them to the best of your ability, sir?" Answer, "Yes, sir, I did." Question, "Did he ask you this question about page 427, where you said that you were acting as an informant?" Answer, "Not then, no, sir." Question. Well, did he ask you about that this morning? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Well, we'll get to that. So now you talked for an hour, maybe until about 5 o'clock, and in that period of time, how many questions would you say he asked you? Answer. I don't know. He repeated the questions many times. He asked them, reframed them differently oftentimes. Question. Now, when is the next time you had occasion to speak with Mr. Ferreira or Mr. Sondheim or Miss Link prior to your testimony here this morning, sir? Answer. This morning. Question. And what time was that, sir? Answer. About 6:15, 6:30. Question. Now, where did that conversation take place? Answer. At the hotel where he was staying. Question. So the two of you have some conversation when we're just the two of you were alone? Answer. Yes. Question. And he showed you something during that time frame? Answer. Yes. Question. And what did he show you? Answer. The statement there. That one that I said I was misstated. Question. He asked you whether you said I was acting as an informant. Is that what he asked you? Answer. Yes, sir. Cochran felt that he'd made his point. At the very least, a pair of weekend strategy sessions ending in pre-dawn darkness on Monday suggested extraordinary dedication by the DA's office. He recalled the same anti-Pratt obsession in 1972 when witnesses like Kenneth Olson and Barbara Reed had sounded like carefully rehearsed stage actors. It was clear that the DA's office was still bent on keeping Geronimo in his cage. In 25 years, nothing had changed. As Judge Dickey had agreed earlier, the court in Santa Ana went dark on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. Most of the lawyers flew home to enjoy a foreshortened holiday season and planned to return to the hotel in Irvine on Christmas night. School was out in San Francisco, and Kathy Ryan and the Hanlon sons planned to join the group in a few days, Kathy to play her old role of legal advisor and the boys to visit Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm. It would be the beginning of a family tragedy that no one could have foreseen.
Context of white supremacy. So picking up next week, we might be one and done. We will have to see how quickly we're able to get through next week. It's one of those where we might have to just suck it up and get through, even if it takes a little overtime, because we could be end up left with something like 10 pages or something goofy like that. So we're going to try our best. Wrap it up next week. All done. Last man standing. That's it. One of our investors finishing up emailed commentary for this week. Devil's advocate, number one, as a career prosecutor and judge, Kaloustian was an expert on trial testimony. His calm judicial demeanor had carried the day. All the pizza eaters agreed that it would be counterproductive to badger Kaloustian about Julius Butler's status as an informant. The most powerful racists are experts in language and maintaining control of their emotions. Absolutely. And he's in his 60s, so he's got years, decades of practice doing this. Next chapter, Kindler and Gentler. Number one, by getting Kaloustian to agree that he would have provided the defense with exculpatory evidence that now was known to exist, he confirmed that Pratt was denied a fair trial. Moreover, Kaloustian skillfully answered questions such that he did not implicate himself, while at the same time not committing perjury. Absolutely. He had lots of plausible deniability. I didn't know, my goodness, this Butler character and his nefarious act, I didn't know nothing about that. Which maybe he didn't, but Johnny Cochran did not have that view. Next, a lawyer's dream. One, Julie Drouse. All we did was bitch about being away from our families. The truth was, we were thrilled and excited. It was Man of La Mancha, To Kill a Mockingbird. It's amazing how often To Kill a Mockingbird is mentioned by suspected racists. I think that book is like the John Brown of American literature. Absolutely. We've talked about it for eons here on The Cows. A raping black male, how could it not be talked about? I've said for years, Harper Lee, that could be that book, To Kill a Mockingbird, can be considered one of the greatest novels in American literature, easily. Easily. And Atticus Finch, absolutely. Good white man, Atticus Finch, who turns out to be racist if you read the sequel to Kill a Mockingbird, Go Tell a Watchman, but, you know, neither here nor there. Next. Oh, and that's it for this week. We'll pick up for next week. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, Henry in Chicago, retired firefighter, Mo in Dallas, if y'all have commentary, should be with us. Any other folks, if you did not get to chime in or think you have observation question you want to add in, don't wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up before we conclude. Folks with hands up, questions, thoughts? Folks still getting their thoughts together. I'll share a thought or two, some of my notes from this section, and then double check again, see if anybody after some time has their thoughts together. Let's see. Going back to the beginning, kindler and gentler. So we discussed this last time. Didn't seem like too many folks were very impressed by Mr. Hanlon's skills as a litigator. So he comes in. I'm going to switch it up. I'm not going to try and make this judge now, Judge Kalustian. I'm not going to try to come in and make him out to be the bad guy. So, you know, I respect you. You respect me, too. Okay, we'll get through this as gentlemen, whatever that means. So they're going through and at least gets him to admit that, yes, if I had known that Butler was an informant, I would have, you know, shared that information. If he had been talking to the FBI, if I had known, I would share that information. If I thought it was relevant and blah, 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 all this. Again, Johnny Cochran felt, hey, it doesn't seem very plausible that he would be ignorant. Again, we got white ignorance. Doesn't seem plausible that he would be poorly informed about all of this, that somehow, some way, nobody says anything to him. And this is a really important case. Like, he doesn't get any of that information. Like, really? Yeah. Let's see. Continuing. The part where they asked Kalustian about when he's talking to, I think it was Long John Washington on the stand, and he says, now you said the FBI has never been involved in this case and you know it. I did not think that was a question back when we read that the first time around. That was a long time ago because that was in trial. That was probably more than a month back. I did not remember hearing that and thinking that it was a question. I thought that that was a statement of fact because it went back. If people remember the context, if you give me a moment, I could probably go back and find it in my highlights. But the context was in this exchange with this witness. The witness was insistent. Yes, the FBI was involved. I know they were agents. I saw their badges. The FBI was involved. At the time, Attorney Kalustian is saying, you know they're not involved. The FBI has never been involved in that case. You're lying on the stand. This is ridiculous. Like, hey, you're not even asking questions. You're just testifying and telling me that I don't know what I'm talking about or I'm lying or whatever the case is. Either way, all of that is wrong because the FBI was involved in the case. So that's another one where, yeah. And I even, that would be another one that, do you think that Kalustian is lying based on this response? I'd say, oh, yeah, absolutely. He was not asking a question there. He was absolutely saying that this witness is not being truthful. The FBI is not involved, which we all know now is not true. So now it's so you didn't know nothing about nothing, Kaloustian. You didn't know the FBI was involved. You didn't know Butler was an informant. You didn't know they had snitches on the team. Nothing. You the most ignorant person in the courtroom? Really? Okay. Johnny Cochran, again, did not take that viewpoint. The legend. Let's see. Didn't know about the informant index? Nothing. Let's see. All right, so the next chapter, A Lawyer's Dream. Yes, now we get to Christmas. Court is supposed to be dark for Christmas Eve. That's in the Word Guide again. I just thought this was interesting. They talked about, you know, the fee for their hotel suites. And now they're stuck like, uh-oh, the bill is due. What are we going to do? And he says a notorious check grabber saved the day. I know, that's interesting. Who is this? And then we have to wait and get, actually have to flip the page to get to, oh, so this was Johnny Cochran who paid the bill. Like, that's interesting. That's like after he's almost kicked off the team and slick suit wearing and all the rest of it. A notorious check grabber. And Johnny Cochran, notorious check grabber or not, is doing this pro bono for nearly 30 years. Like, wow. Seemed like it could have been a more complimentary way of putting that out, but eh, right on for Johnny Cochran picking up the bill. Next. This is another moment where they can turn all this again. They're in Southern California. I love the Orange County area, all of that, Southern California, San Diego, LA, all of that, beaches, warm weather. What's not to love? Christmas time and it's 80 degrees. What's not to love? When Hanlon is talking about, oh, I'm all depressed and this case has worn me down, and in between him snorting lines and whatever else, they are in Southern California with their children, kicking it at the beach, getting some sun. Geronimo Pratt is in a cage. Come on. And he's going to pout. Man, it's ruined our relationship. Just Stuart Hanlon has not impressed me at all. Like, he just seems like the epitome of what I say, affirmative action. Lame attorney, suspected racist, and would be, hey, I'll help get Geronimo Pratt out and work pro bono, and I wear rumpled clothes and had my Jufro the whole time. And anyway, but I thought this was important because they do all this. We had John Brown mentioned and Atticus Finch and all these so-called good white people. And they say, hey, man, we would sit down here and bitch and complain, just like we've heard from Stuart Hanlon this whole time. This has been so lame. You got to work so hard. And Geronimo Pratt is name calling me and calling me dickhead and all the rest of it. And this is so lame. We're doing us. The truth is we were thrilled and excited. The case was going well. A defense lawyer's dream to kill a mockingbird. Now, even that is interesting because, I mean, they are comparing themselves to Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, who is a racist. This is a film that's set in Alabama in like 1940. This guy, black guy's been accused of a rape that he didn't do. White woman came on to him and he resisted. Rethinking Rufus, the man not black, Miss Andrea, all that. Atticus Finch has a black female housewife that he could just order around. Like, I think I'm going to have to stay out tonight. Calpurnia, stay with my children and watch him. Okay. She can't do it. Does she have a family? Is she taken care of? We don't know. Does she get Social Security? No. But they see themselves as Atticus Finch. Like, are you serious? How lame is that? I guess maybe you have to know To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a movie if you don't want to read the book. I think we had to read the book in high. I've read the book and I've seen the movie. I think we were required to read that book in school, as many generations of children have been. But I've also seen the movie as well. And like, wow, Atticus Finch does not strike me as like, yeah, this is a white man or white person in general that you want to, you know, emulate or strive to be like in terms of friend to the nigra. He did encourage his child not to say nigger, if that means anything. Let's see. And they're stuck in Orange County with John Wayne and the Nixon sucks. But we loved every second of it. Hypocrisy, man. Just say that. We love this. We can give our sob story about how hard it was and Johnny Cochran paid for our $8,000 hotel tab. Like, yeah. Let's see. Incidentally, I did agree with not having Kathleen Cleaver at the table. Like, number one, this is not the recognition moment. Like, you can do that later. We're trying to get you out of prison. And kind of the same thing they were thinking with Johnny Cochran. Like, man, how many unruly Negroes do we need to have in the courtroom? Like, we already got Johnny Cochran. They're trying to fix his ass. We got you talking about Geronimo Pratt. Like, we do not need any more unruly Negroes at the table. Like, at all. None. Have her sit in the back of the courtroom, or maybe have her just watch it on television. Like, no more Panther people. Like, no. Let's see. Oh, and they mentioned Charles. I didn't even know who Charles Ng, I think is how you pronounce it. I didn't even know who he was. That happened with the McMartin case, too. I had to stop and look. Now, think of all the people. Geronimo Pratt done nothing. It's Memorial Day weekend. I'm a two-tour Vietnam veteran. Totally innocent. And we've heard I'm in prison kicking it with the Aryan Brotherhood. And Charles Manson, Charles Ng. Who is Charles Ng? They say, killer or not, Ng deserves no mercy. My flesh crawls when I see Charles Ng. This is from the LA Times. I picture him in the woods with depraved Leonard Lake lending a hand, burying a corpse. He's admitted to that. He did not confess to the killing of 7 men, 3 women, 2 children. May he rot in hell regardless, whether he did everything or did nothing while enslaved victims cried and died. Ng was party to mass murder. He was there. He told no one. He saved no one. He was by Lake's side while defenseless humans were held captive, then methodically violated, tortured, slain, dismembered. There is little as fiendish as a man who appears on a videotape telling a terrified, tied up woman, "You can cry and stuff like the rest of them. It won't do you no good." Apparently, he killed for 15 years before he was caught in Canada. Blame Canada. This is your cellmate, they say in the book. And then Charles Ng, who kept explaining to anyone who would listen that it was his partner, Lake, who committed the crimes. And Geronimo has to tell them, God, the things with you and Charles Manson and the Mexican mafia and everybody, leave me alone. Doing my meditation. Got shrapnel in my body. I'm trying to get my case together. They can't even sneak me a pastrami sandwich without looking at me tough. Like, leave me alone. Let's see. They talked about all he missed out on. He was upset being down here because all the other folks are having fun. They're at the beach, bringing their family down, kicking it. SoCal is great. Not Mr. Pratt. He can't hang out, do all this stuff. He's got to be in the cage and everything. They described him as a social animal. He can't just be a social human being. That's why I say pay attention to the metaphors. What I said last segment, now I said they got discretion. Kalustian, oh, it's no problem. Butler needs a gun. Yeah, the Negroes are after him. Go ahead and keep your gun. I know you're a felon. You're not supposed to have a gun, but go ahead and keep it anyway. This time around, the discretion, Cochran is remembering the O.J. Simpson trial. We tried to sneak him a pastrami sandwich, and the deputy acted like we were bringing in an assault rifle, one of those 50 caliber brands. Said we were warned if we did it again, we'd go to jail. Potato chips? That's the second time somebody has been threatened like this over potato chips and a pastrami sandwich in this book. Discretion. Let's see. Christmas Eve. They bring Butler back. If folks remember O.J. Simpson, so they bring Butler back to the witness stand. And we got a witness being mollycoddled again. Remember that verb from O.J. Simpson? There we go. They were upset because they had to mollycoddle Mark Furman. Make sure you don't say nigger on the stand and all the rest of it. Get your act together and all this. They got to do the same thing with Butler. They got to meet with him at 6:30 in the morning and have all these weekend calls. Brilliant job by Johnny Cochran bringing that all to light. But consistent pattern with the L.A. District Attorney's Office, a pattern that I think you'll hear again in the next book. Let's see. And even the judge has to step in like, dude, what? Are you saying, Butler, that the attorneys were calling and giving you the questions and the answers that they wanted you to give? Like, what? Which is illegal. Like, what? What is going on here? What is, indeed, what is going on here, Marvin Gaye? Let's see. Now, remember last week they were talking about Jim McCloskey, the white reverend and all this Catholic. They were talking about, do we need to get rid of Johnny Cochran? Let's think about it. Maybe. Then he comes back this week, seated in the front row. McCloskey was impressed with Cochran's aplomb. Never heard him say he was impressed with Stuart Hanlon. Johnny turns every courtroom into his personal stage. Just a side comment. If that's true, if you can do that successfully at every trial, and it seemed Johnny was able to do that. He wasn't perfect. He didn't win every trial. But wow, it seemed like he had that persona every time out. Maybe the slick suits and the verbiage, maybe that's a part of making that courtroom your stage, which is all for the benefit of your client. Anyway, yeah, I can stop there. I am a little bummed that this is weaving into, oh, we got to stop and weep for a white person in Charles Stewart's wife passing away when Geronimo Pratt's life has been taken away from him and all the other black people. But we'll pick up there next week, and hopefully we will stamp and wrap the book up next week. Did any of the other folks who listening in comment here, they want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Nothing stood out. Second audio segment. Nothing special. Oh, we will wrap up next time around. I would hope folks are, you know, minimum paying attention. Lots of parallel, not just with O.J. Simpson, but probably lots of parallels with lots of black people who do not get books and documentaries and that type of a thing, don't get to go hang out with my BFF Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, which Geronimo Pratt did. A lot of victims of racism do not get that type of treatment, but they get the other side, where you get prosecutors who go in and lie and just charge you with things where you totally did not do this, and you've lost 10, 15, 20 years. I think they just got the book out for one of the Central Park Five. Again, that's a lot more coverage than a lot of black people get who end up in this exact predicament. Life still, like I said, don't even know what clothes are in fashion anymore. Don't know what's going on in the world. I am totally lost in time about everything, where white people just decided, we got a crime and we think it's you, Negro. You'll be the one that we charge for this one and we can make it stick. Don't believe us, try. You will not have a Johnny Cochran to get you out of this one. So, yeah, you can plead it out or what even. Matter of fact, we might not even have to charge you. We can do the Khalil Browder. You don't even get charged, and we still get you in greater confinement for years. System of racism, white supremacy. Wow. Again, we should be wrapping up next week. We will have to see. At minimum, we'll be like right there, like a chapter left, so it'll be really, really a strong effort to see if we can conclude next Thursday. But if not, very brief, hit it and quit it literally for the following week. But we'll see what we can do. And regardless, Labyrinth should be the next book, The Assassination of Tupac Shakur, Notorious B.I.G. Hopefully, if folks pay attention or at least listen consecutively to the book club, all of this will matter, come together in kind of a comprehensive way. Maybe we can all think a little bit differently about some of these episodes that garnered a lot of attention throughout the 1990s. In fact, maybe we can even go full circle. We can finish out our LA series if we get through with Labyrinth sometime this summer. Maybe we can even do Rodney King and round it out all the way through, find one really good book to go over what happened there, and that'll kind of put a nice cap on some of these major events from the 1990s in the Los Angeles area that either we were alive and captivated by a lot of these events and or have heard about them repeatedly if you were born after the 1990s. All of that said, much obliged for the folks who tuned in, either live, archive. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Reading, more important than watching television. We'll be here tomorrow, Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and Saturday for the compensatory call-in. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer, and particularly in a system where so many black people get accused of things all the time, you might be in a slightly better position if, at minimum, hey, I was sober, I have a clear recollection of my activities at this time, and since I was sober, I don't have any concerns about, oh my goodness, I was inebriated during this time period and all the rest. Like, man, let's stay sober, try to minimize some of our problems as best we can. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. If you got to go out and about, man, they just had the shooting, the San Jose shooting. That was a workplace incident. We will be talking about that tomorrow. I've been saying it for a while. When you go out and about, be mindful of your surroundings. Anybody looks, something is a little bit awry. They're being hostile and loud. This is not a time for confrontation. You should be thinking, this gal, this guy could be armed. In fact, they might have a whole entourage of folks who are armed, ready to do some killing. Might have a Charles Ng, Charles Manson in the crew with them. You never know. Be very mindful. Folks are rowdy and for lots of different reasons out and about, especially in the U.S. This is not a good time for verbal confrontations with strangers. All of that said, if you are going out, you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, we need all of our attention, and we need to be mindful about things that are happening around us, trying to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe, doing the small things, not being on the cell phone, not being intoxicated, just the small things that we can control. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. I guess we don't have to be Geronimo Pratt patient with Julius Butler, but I mean, that's a pretty good example, all things considered. Help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. Had a little bit of that this week. I can certainly understand after 30 years, I'd probably do some name calling too. But whew, the folks who are most to blame are all classified as white. I don't even think we should name call them. Minimizing conflict with non-white people, also hugely important. Something that has also been illustrated in this book, or at least the importance of minimizing conflict with other non-white people. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.